Rich Kimble and Bruce Pratt here, and it's time for Sports Lit 101. And so excited to welcome our next guest in. We're looking forward to this book from the very first moment we heard the concept, and we read it, we loved it, we told everybody we could to get their hands on the book, and now we get a chance to talk to the author of what I think is hands down the best baseball book of the year. The book is The Wax Pack, and we are thrilled to be joined this afternoon by author Brad Baluchian. Brad, thanks for being with us.
It sounds like I owe you guys a commission.
No, not needed. Not needed, because you brought some sunshine to us in, sort of a dark time here. And we were talking about just a few moments ago before we went to break. Everybody we've talked to about this book, particularly the writers, all say the same thing. God, what a great idea. Why didn't I think of that?
Yeah, I've heard that a lot myself.
For anybody who doesn't know, can you explain the genesis of this book?
Sure. I grew up in Rhode Island and went down to the local pharmacy with my allowance every week to buy wax packs in the late 80s, and had thousands of cards. And I always liked the guys. My favorite players were guys like Marty Barrett that were not the star players. And so I always wonder, I think the theme of where are they now is something that appeals to everybody in various industries. And so I always wanted to find out what happened to the guys that I grew up idolizing and collecting their cards, especially those underdog guys. And so I just had the idea that a pack of cards would give you the perfect vehicle to get a random sample. And, you know, when you get 15 random players, just by probability, most of those guys are going to be the underdog types that I idolized.
One of the things I did when I was a kid, my dad had a small store. I grew up in Connecticut. Was do the same thing. When I got allowance, I got cards. There were only five at that time. One of the things that I think it took me longer than anything else to understand was there was a reason that you got five of one guy before you got any of another guy. It's a long time before I sort of put that together. And I think that maybe that's part of the magic in collecting cards.
Yeah, I know. It's just that random. I mean, the surprise you get when opening a pack is something that there's too little of in our society nowadays, when everything is so customized and controlled and there's content forever. So I think that doing a book based on a single pack captured the surprise element, but also the randomness of, you know, you go with the hand that you're playing, whatever cards are dealt to you. And so when I had the idea, I then took it another step further and said, well, I want to write a book where I actually get to go on the road and make it into this crazy road adventure and write about the road trip to find all the guys in a single pack of cards. And so that's kind of the genesis of the book itself.
And what was remarkable out of all these players from 30 plus years ago is that when you set out on the journey, only one of them had passed away at that point.
Yeah, and to be fair, in the spirit of full disclosure, in case you have any cynical listeners, I did open up multiple packs because of that. You know, if I got a pack that had six guys that had passed away, it'd be a pretty short road trip. So, but I can say that I maintained the integrity of the pack and that I didn't mix cards between packs.
You know, you mentioned you grew up in Rhode Island and that you had this fascination with the letter F and you became a Phillies fan. Was any part of becoming a Phillies fan what happens to a lot of kids in Southern New England? They don't want to get caught in the Yankee Red Sox rivalry, so they want to root for somebody else. I know my younger son was that way.
Man, it was hard growing up a Phillies fan in the late 80s anywhere in the country.
That's true.
And, you know, I think, you know, people – it wasn't that I never followed the crowd. So rooting for the Red Sox was out, and the Yankees to me represented like the ultimate, you know, sort of evil, because they were just the anti underdog, you know. So I had no skin in that game. And as a Phillies fan, you were just kind of viewed as like a neutral nation, you know. People kind of have some pity for you, but don't really get very emotionally riled up when you mention the Phillies back then.
Now, you made your first venture, the first player you sought out, one of my favorite players, because I also love the utility guys, the unsung heroes. And I feel like your visit with Rance Mullinix really kind of set the stage for what was to follow.
Yeah, you know, I benefited. There's a lot of serendipity in this book in the way things just happened to work out, in that Rance was sort of a nice foil or a nice sort of, like, beginning ground for what came next, because he was just so friendly, so accommodating, just a really down to earth, solid guy. You know, he had some interesting backstories to share, but everything went really well with him. And so it kind of creates in the beginning of the book this sort of this great momentum right out of the gate. And you start to think, as I started to think, maybe this is all going to just go perfectly and all the guys are going to be so easy to find and to talk to. And then, of course, as you see, you know, around the middle of the book, start to have some roadblocks and some failures and, you know, guys that wouldn't talk to me. So there's a certain ebb and flow to the emotion of the book. And I think, you know, Rance was a nice way to start strong and kind of set you up for what would come next.
One of the, I thought was the most interesting chapter to me was the chapter 7, Carmen's Cradle, where you actually, before you met the player, you decided to go see where he came from. And it seems that the book after that really becomes even more introspective as it regards your life. And, you know, where do I come from and where do I fit in this? And how does this road trip work? Is that a good observation on my part or am I off the rails there?
No, that's good. It's also, it was sort of self-indulgent for me to do that chapter because no other player gets that treatment, right? And it actually requires me to go the wrong direction. So I'm driving from California east and I'm in Texas and I decide to go back west a few hundred miles or more to find this little tiny town where Don Carmen grew up just because he was my favorite player. And I tried to be as honest and transparent as I could in the book about acknowledging those indulgences and basically saying, you know, to the reader, bear with me, I know this may seem strange, but I'm going to go take this little detour because it's so important to me to be able to see where my childhood hero came from. And I mean, the fact that he came from such a place that there's so much to talk about because there's so little in Camargo, Oklahoma. I mean, it from a travel writing perspective, it was really eye-opening. And so to be able to have a story about this little tiny town in the middle of the prairie in the same book as a chapter about going to Compton and near Los Angeles. I mean, that to me just encapsulates the diversity of experiences and places that are in the book, which made it so much fun to write because I really got to see these extremes of the country.
We're talking with Brad Baluchian about his wonderful book, The Wax Pack. And here in New England, of course, I think the reaction people will have is to the story of Carlton Fisk, who always has had the reputation as being, we'll use the word aloof. And I laughed out loud at some of your interactions with him and with the people who kept you from getting too close to him.
Yeah. Carlton, I always knew it would be difficult. I mean, he turned down Bob Costas, right? He didn't even talk to the guy that wrote the biography of him. So if you're not going to help a guy who's writing 340 pages about you, you know, what are the odds that he's going to talk to me? So, you know, I still tried to go through all the same channels that I went through with the other guys to try to get him to talk, and he said no. So then I kind of go rogue, as you alluded to, and, you know, do this whole thing in Florida where I pretend like I'm a millionaire or interested in buying a house on a golf course. And it was fun to kind of mix that in because the book can be kind of, you know, somber and heavy at times. So to have that levity was nice.
Well, you talk about somber. One of the things I thought made this such a great book, it's a book about baseball as much as it's not about baseball. And there are so many sort of baseball travelogues that are just reportage. This happened, that happened, this happened. I thought the way that you examined baseball from the inside and the outside through these people was different than any. And we cover hundreds of books a year on this show and we read them all. But it's not something I'd seen in a baseball book before.
Well, thank you. And I mean, that was, it feels good to get that response because I had to fight so hard in the process of trying to publish the book to execute that vision, because most of the people, the gatekeepers in the publishing industry, in the midst of my 38 rejections that I received, I was told, you know, make it more about baseball. Don't put yourself in it this much. Take a back seat to the rest of the, you know, the kind of conceit that I had in the book, which I always knew was very ambitious because it is something that's not typically done and it's very unusual. But I always felt like that was the best way to maximize the potential of this idea, that I wanted to scale up so that the book became, the meaning of the book was bigger than baseball, that it was about our relationship with fear, that it was about vulnerability, especially among men. You know, things that I think everybody can relate to, which to me was more interesting artistically than just a book about baseball.
And as you point out, when you started on your journey, you were at an age where if you were a major league ball player, you'd be getting to the end of the line. And we forget about what a short career these guys have, that moment in the sun for them. And so much of the book is about how they have adjusted to life post-baseball. And I think it's very ironic that the guy who had the shortest career in the big leagues probably has done the best since his time in the game came to an end.
Yeah, I made up this statistic for all the analytics people called life war, which is, you know, if you apply war to life, Jaime Kokenauer would be in the Hall of Fame because he's the guy you were just talking about, that the least accomplished baseball player is probably the most well-adjusted person in the entire book.
I found the story of Gary Templeton to be very poignant. And you'll remember him as a player, of course, but also remember the rumor, the things that were said about him. And when you read about how all of that began, I mean, you feel bad for this guy who was a tremendous, for a time, considered to be a Hall of Fame candidate early in his career, who carried around some baggage that maybe wasn't completely justified.
Yeah, I think that I really was really happy to be able to kind of set the record straight about that story. I didn't know I was going to get so much material out of that, but when I sat down to talk to him, he clearly wanted to talk and he clearly wanted to tell what actually happened, you know, his side of that story. And it was really, as I dug into it and went back and read the newspaper accounts at the time, it was really disappointing to me to see how all of that was reported. And, you know, really, when you read that story, you realize how unfairly difficult it was for black players to come into professional baseball back in the 70s and, you know, how hard that climate was for them.
When you look back on all the visits you made, which player surprised you the most by the way they were? I mean, other than Daryl, who doesn't show up and things like that, you went looking for somebody and they turned out to be remarkably different or.
Yeah. I'd say generally guys were consistent, except some exceptions were, Templeton, I thought, was going to be maybe a little more aloof, and he was very outgoing and kind of silly and fun. And then Steve Yeager, he was pretty much measured up to what I had expected, but I was surprised at this very soft side to him because he kind of, you know, he's known as this sort of just this really outgoing, kind of tough, brash guy. And yet when I talked to him side by side with his son, you could just see this incredibly soft and sensitive side to him, where he even said something. I asked him something like, "What is it that people get wrong about you?" And he said that, you know, they think that I'm just a, you know, this tough guy all the time. And his son was saying that, you know, how he gets emotional, like watching his son's accomplish different things. And his son was kind of teasing him about that. And I mean, that's one of the things that, one of the themes in the book is how many guys did get emotional and were sort of opened up and were very vulnerable with me, which I really appreciated, but didn't expect. I mean, and that ends up becoming a major theme in the book.
I love the Richie Hebner chapter because growing up here in New England, when Hebner was playing, the story you would always hear was, well, he's a gravedigger in the off season, but it was great to hear the full story of that and his family dynamic as well.
Yeah, and Richie, you know, I don't know if I didn't get as much. I felt like he was the one guy I talked to that I didn't get a whole lot get him to let his guard down a whole lot. But I think that may have also been because he was in the middle of the season. He was a hitting coach and it was a game day. So, you know, I mean, I could see where he was not as at ease as some of the other guys. But that chapter to me was, and this was where I was really grateful to all the supporting cast of these players to talk to me. So Richie's brother, Dennis, talking to him told me a lot about Richie. Doc Gooden talking to his oldest son, Dwight Gooden Jr., told me a lot about what Doc is like. And, you know, that was it was really nice to go beyond just the player and to actually engage their family members as well.
Yeah, I made a mistake. I said Daryl when I meant Doc. I don't want to give Daryl Strawberry any bad press that he deserves. Do you think it would be possible to do this again?
Oh, I could do it again for sure. I don't think it would be as good though. You know, that's why I've squelched the idea of me doing a sequel, because from an artistic creative point of view, the novelty is gone. I mean, it would be fun. I'm sure I get some great stories, but part of the appeal of the book, I think, is also me as a character telling my story, and I've already told my story, you know, I mean,
right.
I couldn't do that again. So I think, you know, there's a lot of other ideas that I had about fun books to write, but I don't think it would be smart for me to do the same thing again.
We were talking last week with Jeff Daniels, the actor and singer-songwriter. He grew up as a big Tigers fan and just wrote a wonderful song about his boyhood hero, Al Kaline. But as he told us, too, that song, like so much, is also about fathers and sons. And there's such a strong element of that in your book as well, because that bond remains great throughout baseball.
Yeah, and that was something I didn't know was going to become such a big part of the book. I mean, clearly it's a big part of baseball, but it wasn't until I started talking to, I had heard from Steve Yeager about how his father was an alcoholic who passed out in the clubhouse watching him play. And then I heard from Randy Reddy about how his dad, you know, built this whole pitching mound for him and then threw one pitch and then never play catch with him again. These really just sad stories about fathers and how strained their relationships were with their dads. And, I started to realize, like, wow, this is a theme. And then that became a bigger part of the book. And, you know, sure enough, there were several examples of guys that really suffered from their relationships with their dad. But there were also some incredibly uplifting stories about relationships with their fathers, like Lee Mazzilli and Rance Mullinix. And then I kind of talked about my own story, which was, you know, generally a very good relationship with my dad, but struggling with something a lot of men, I think, struggle with is when their fathers are sort of emotionally distant or they're not able to communicate their emotions very openly, you know, how we deal with that.
Well, you're in a sixth printing, I believe. You've hit the Los Angeles Times bestseller list. Obviously, when you write the book, you hope, you dream it will be a big success. But could have imagined that this thing would have caught the zeitgeist, if you will, of the time, that people have embraced this in an incredible level and at all various walks of life? Anybody who loves baseball seems to have found their way to this book and love the message that you have out there.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I one of the themes in the book is to be very careful about expectations, right? So I was pretty humbled in the process of trying to get the book published. I was just grateful to get it out there. And now it just feels really good that so many people are enjoying it.
Well, we absolutely loved it. It's so great for us to have the chance to talk with you about the Wax Pack this afternoon. Brad, thank you so much for making time for us. And thanks for your great work. Your road trip paid off for all of the baseball fans out there.
All right. Anytime. And thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Brad Bellucci, and the book is The Wax Pack.